Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event. Able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
Hey everyone, you're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host Dave.
And Ben.
And John.
And this week, we actually have a very special guest with us. He has worked for both Marvel and DC. He's also worked for Malibu and Atari. He has worked on Detective Comics, The Avengers, Doctor Strange, Captain America, Justice League of America. An insane
list goes on and on.
Yes, an insane laundry list. He's created so many characters for both universes. Most notably, the main character and the biggest moneymaker last year. Of course, we're talking about Star-Lord in Guardians of the Galaxy. Everyone, please welcome Steve Englehart to the show.
Star-Lord.
Hey,
how are you doing, sir?
Good.
Sorry,
I had to do that.
how's the weather out there in sunny California?
It's pretty sunny. It's in about 70 degrees and sunny. Where are you guys?
Philadelphia area.
Yeah, we're in Philly, and it's we got some snow earlier.
Well, you get snow every couple of days for the last 6 months, right?
Yeah,
it seems
exactly.
That way. Snow and sun.
Yeah.
All right, so as our listeners know, before we get into this, we do our Geek of the Week. Last week's question, since it was Ben's question, I'll let him reiterate the question.
So the question, which I didn't get to express because I wasn't on the show last week, there is, through whatever reasons you might find, a person who has managed to play two roles in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, as it's been established. Just to be clear on the parameters of that, that's all the movies made by Marvel, not counting the ones by Fox or Sony, and the TV shows that they're making under that same umbrella, that continuity. There is one actor, besides Stan Lee, who has played in face and voice two different roles. And the question was, who was that person?
Yes.
And we had an answer, Dave?
Yes. Well, actually, we have...
Who is our winner, or Beard of Knowledge for this week, Dave?
Well, it's funny. My daughter actually said... because when I asked the question, I didn't specify Stan Lee. So she came back with and said Stan Lee. And I'm like, no, he doesn't count.
He doesn't count.
Yeah.
Unless he becomes the Watcher, which is yet to be seen.
Yes. So we're actually going to do something that I swore I wouldn't do when I started this, but the only person to get the answer correct was last week's winner. So Nathan Withrow, again, you are the Geek of the Week, or as Ben says, the Honorary Beard of Knowledge, so congratulations.
So the answer was Enver Gyojai, who is, I practiced that today, I still got it wrong. He was in the first Avengers movie, not the first Avenger, but the Avengers movie that came before the one coming up, as a police officer on the street who did have a line of dialogue with Captain America. But he was more recently and more notably visible in the Agent Carter TV series as Agent Sousa.
Yes, yes.
So, for those playing at home.
So yes, he's the only actor to actually play two different roles in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That, of course, is not counting...
So far.
That's not like, you know, Chris... Because people were saying Chris Evans, because, you know, he was Captain America, and, of course, Johnny Storm.
What do you
and
mean?
A bunch of people were answering
when,
like
when
that.
Was he Johnny Storm? I don't recall this, Dave.
Yeah, that Fox makes those Fantastic Four movies. Don't
you mean the ones
that
don't exist?
I'd be happy to. I'd be interested to see when one of those come out.
So anyway, actually, guys,
you have a question for this week, Dave?
I thought you had a question, Ben.
Yes, Dave, what is the question of the week?
All right. So the question of the week is, it's in honor of our guest. So, nah, never mind. We're not going to do that.
Oh, let's do that.
Because I was going to say, in what story was, oh God, my mind just went blank. Star-Lord, first published. What book was his, was, the first story featuring Star-Lord published?
Huh, I bet I know somebody who knows that.
I bet I do. So we'll talk about Star-Lord, but we won't talk about that aspect of it. How's that?
All right.
So.
Spoilers.
So there you go. That's the question of the week. If you think you know the answer, again, hashtag StumpTheGeekSpeak to Twitter or put it on our Facebook page, and we will pick a winner for next week. All right. So, sir. you live in California, but you're not originally from California, correct? You're from the Midwest?
Yeah. Indiana. Actually, I spent most of my childhood in Louisville, so.
Oh, okay.
In there.
And was writing something you've always wanted to do?
That's a tricky question. There are examples of my writing stuff when I was like, 8 years old. Mm-hmm. But what I wanted to do was be an artist in comics. It was the comic art that really sucked me in, and that's what I wanted to do. And then I got sidetracked into writing, and you can write a whole lot faster than you can draw, so I just kept doing that. But somehow working in comics, yeah, that was probably always a long-term concept.
Oh, cool. I did not know that about you. I'm a little curious. Have you, tried to keep up with the drawing at all, or?
Not really. I started out. My earliest stuff in comics was art, but I did like a couple of romance stories. I did a monster story. I was on staff at Marvel as an assistant editor, and then they needed something written and handed it to me, and they liked what I did, and I liked doing it. And so all of a sudden, I was getting a lot of. The way Marvel worked, if they liked you, then they gave you something else. And if they liked that, they kept giving you more. And then, so I went from, nothing to a couple of romance stories, to a couple of monster stories, to the Beast, to Captain America and the Defenders, like the next month, to the Avengers, like the next month. And it was like, boom. So all of a sudden I had no time to draw. It just fell by the wayside. But I find that I still, when I look at comics, I'm not alone, but I get sucked in by the art because you got to take time to read. So,
right. So, according to the wonderful Wikipedia, and we know how accurate that always is. It does say
by committee.
You started out as assisting Neil Adams and Denny O'Neill in Warren Publishing's black and white horror comic Vampirella for number 10.
Yeah, actually, just Neil. It was a script by Denny, but Neil was just doing it as a job. We weren't collaborating with Denny, and then so I worked with Neil on that, and the interesting thing there was that Neil insisted that my name be credited. Neil Adams and Steve Englehart as the art on this thing. And the difference between what he could do and what I could do was immense. Yes. But his idea was to get my name, as a printed credit, which would help me, go forward with my career. So that's the kind of guy he was,
Yeah, I've actually met Mr. Adams at quite a few conventions and talked to him about this stuff. And it seems like that's always been something very important to him, to make sure people get the right credit they deserve for the work that they do.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm sure is something you don't always get in this industry. So from there, like you said, you worked on more and more in different stories. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, so you've been working in comics now for decades. What would you say? Obviously the comic landscape has changed significantly over that time. What would you say the biggest changes you saw or maybe felt you had any impact on?
Well, I think I had an impact on a number of things, but I was coming at it from a more meta standpoint. I mean, I think the biggest changes that I've seen, obviously, you know, it used to be four color printing on pulp paper, and now it's full Photoshop on slick paper.
Yeah.
Which went along with the idea that it used to be a dime and now it's, you know, $5. But that leads to what I think is the biggest, you know, if I were going to say the biggest change, when they were a dime, even though, you know, everybody made a whole lot less money and things cost a whole lot less money and blah, 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 blah. It was certainly possible without going nuts to sort of buy every comic out there. I mean, you could buy all the Marvels and all the DCs and all the Gold Keys and all the Charltons and all the, you know, whatever. And so if you were a fan, you were sort of immersed in the entire field of comics. You know, Russ Manning doing Magnus Robot Fighter over at Gold Key was not, you know, something that was way off the map. It was, you know, it was part of the map. And so I think people had a more, a much larger sense of what the entire industry consisted of. I, you know, now when things do cost, you know, a number of dollars per issue, are we there?
Yeah.
Oh, I heard something beep. I thought maybe
It wasn't us.
Okay. Maybe something had cut out. Somebody may be calling me. I don't know. my other interview. so I, you know, that's, I liked that, sort of knowing everything. And now I think people, you know, they know the Marvel universe, or maybe they know a part of the Marvel universe. But the idea of buying every comic out there is probably beyond, you know, most people's ability to do, whether they want to or not. So, that's, it's just changed. You know, I used to think of comics sort of as a field, I guess, and now it's more like an area of specialty for whatever it is that you find interesting. So that's changed just the way people come at comics and what people bring to comics.
Right.
It's interesting your point of view on that. I never thought about it that way, where like when DC launched their new 52, you know, again, this is an industry too, where I think it's in some ways, you know, they're struggling to keep their audience and find new ways to get people involved and to launch 52 titles, you know, relaunch 52 titles basically. At that point, it was a bold move. You know, what do you think about that kind of move?
Well, again, I think what I was just talking about pretty much colors my view of the whole thing.
Right.
When I was writing comics in the 70s and the 80s, Marvel, of course, liked to do crossovers, and it was just sort of a thing. You know, it'd be kind of cool if the Fantastic Four and Daredevil ended up in the same comic or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I just took that as a matter of course. And then when I was working on the Ultraverse in the 90s, we did a thing where we did a company-wide story that, you know, required you to sort of buy all the books. And for the first time, people were writing in and going, what the hell is this? You know, why are you making us buy all these books? It's, you know, it's costing us a lot of money. We're not into it. And that just really surprised me. You know, the idea that you wouldn't want to, primarily for financial reasons, I suppose, get involved with everything, that was a surprise to me. So now, you know, again, I mean, if you say, come buy 52 number ones, you might do that because they're all number ones, but, you know, then buying the number twos, the number threes, that's a lot of damn books to have to buy.
Right.
And I'm sure that was, you know, DC would love for you to do that, but I just think it's a much, I mean, once it was a slam dunk, and now I don't think it's at all a slam dunk. So,
right. Yeah. Speaking
as somebody who lived through that time,
which time are we talking?
All the crossovers. I'm old. It was nice to see a crossover every once in a while, and it made it special. Uh-huh. And then it got to the point where every book had a crossover. Yeah. And I literally remember, at the end of college, not being able to afford the number of books I needed to keep up with the damn storylines.
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, particularly in the 90s when Marvel, just before they went bankrupt, they were putting out, you know, 47 number ones a month, and now they all had variant covers and they all came in bags. And the idea was, well, sure, everybody will buy this stuff and we'll get rich. And then it turned out that that wasn't the case and they went bankrupt. So, you know, it was people cashing in and people cashing in those days. You know, DC's motivation, I couldn't tell you, other than to just draw attention to themselves. You know, I mean, that was certainly one of them. But yeah, that's, you know, it's just the it's much, much harder to just stay on top of comics as an entity now.
Right.
So yeah, Yeah,
I kind of feel, though, in a way, Marvel's kind of doing the opposite with their Secret Wars event coming up. In the sense of, like, yes, they're doing another massive crossover, but it seems like they're trying to streamline everything at this point. And, I mean, they've announced a bunch of titles they've already canceled in preparation for this crossover. You know, some of them being, you know, some of the titles shocked me. I think, you know, Wolverine was in the list. Believe one of the X-Men books right now, you know.
Even Amazing Spider-Man was on the list.
Oh, yes.
I was just reading, right? I mean, sales are dropping every year. They're down, you know. That's another thing, I suppose, if I were going to talk about changes. Back in the 70s, as the old guy there will know, you know, people who liked comics, and everybody else in the world knew that, or everybody else in America knew that they were just crap and wouldn't even look at them. I mean, you'd go to people on occasion and say, you really should look at this. This is really cool. And they'd go, no, I know it's crap. I don't have to look at it.
Yeah.
And the fact that now everybody knows who Iron Man and Spider-Man and the Avengers are because of the movies, that's a huge change. Yeah. And the flip side of that is all those people know all those characters by way of Robert Downey Jr. They have no clue as to, you know, Bob Layton and, you know, Archie Goodwin and people who, you know, who did those comics or do those comics. I think, you know, the comic impulse has obviously switched over to the big screen, and the books themselves are not keeping up their end of the whole process. And so, you know, it is surprising, you would think, that Wolverine or whatever would not continue to work, but you can get Wolverine on the big screen, played by Hugh Jackman, you know, so a lot of people probably, that's all they want to see.
Yeah.
I want to ask you something as a writer, you know, again, with like launching 52 titles or having these mass crossovers and whatnot, sometimes it feels like it's quantity over quality. And does that upset you as a writer? Do you think it's better to write to try to get a huge audience or to just try to write good stories?
Oh, well, I'm in favor of writing good stories. I mean, when they started, you know, I couldn't even tell you, but probably the third Spider-Man book, somewhere in there, they offered it to me. And I said, no, I don't want to write the third Spider-Man book. You know, I mean, if I'm going to write Spider-Man, I want to write Spider-Man and not have to, you know, do all those logistics and have different versions of him out there and all that kind of stuff. I mean, so I'm old school enough to want to do, you know, to do the character, to do the world that the guy's in, et cetera, and make that the best I can. You know, I worked as a professional for a long time. So, I mean, I understand when publishers say, hey, let's make a whole lot more money doing something or other. When they started doing, you know, big country, company-wide crossovers every summer that involved a whole lot of titles, I thought the quality went down, and I wasn't always thrilled with what we were being asked to do, but that was the job. I mean, they'd say, you know, turn the sky red and put the X-Men in your book this month. And it's like, okay, well, you know, I'll take my best shot at that. But it wasn't coming from a creative impulse, certainly.
Right. Continuity. Imitation.
Yeah.
Seem like in these days with these types of huge meta arcs that are much more common these days, it seems, than they used to be, that there's got to be teams of people whose job it is just to keep track of continuity, which I don't get the sense that that was always the case.
No. Well, you know, when in, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s, whatever, it was the writer's responsibility to know the history, the continuity, whatever. If you were going to write the Hulk, you were supposed to know what there was to know about the Hulk. And if somebody wanted to do a Hulk crossover, they would come to you and they'd say, here's what we're doing in my book. Can we connect it? And you'd go, yeah. And you would do that. Then I, you know, so I got out of comics in the late 90s after the Ultraverse went under. And then I came back in the early 2000s to do a few things for Marvel. And the first thing they offered me was a Hellcat thing, because I'd done Hellcat back in the Avengers back in the day, and they wanted to kind of clean her up, and they asked me to do that, and they said, and you know, since you were last here, she married the devil and she committed suicide and she's come back again, and you know, and I'm like, okay, and they said, I said, well, I'm, you know, I got to apologize because I don't really know that stuff, and they said, oh no, it's the editor's job now to know that, you know, the editor's supposed to tell you what it is you need to know. And in fact, in that, I don't even remember what it was, but something in that Hellcat thing was like wrong because I hadn't been told what the right thing was. And, you know, for about 5 seconds, I felt bad about that because that wasn't the way I was trained on. Any of us were trained to do it. And in the sixth second, I said, not my fault, you know, So, yeah, I mean, it's only the editors who really understand that stuff now. I mean, maybe Brian Michael Bendis does, or, you know, whatever. But I know those company-wide crossovers come from the editors going off somewhere for a weekend and sitting around and saying, you know, let's turn the Hulk red and you know, and go from there. So it's all coming from the editors downward now, as opposed from the creative people upward.
Yeah, sometimes I wonder if I mean, I definitely believe Bendis knows the Ultimate Universe inside and out. But it just seems like, you know, every once in a while when he wants to inject the Spider-Man story, let's say, into regular continuity, he knows what's going on with Spider-Man at that moment, you know? Because again, it has to be tough to know everything that's happened with these characters. You know, though someone like Grant Morrison, you know, he said in countless interviews that he tries to take in as much of like Batman's history going all the way back to the 40s whenever he writes a story,
right,
and make that all part of his history. So, you know, hats off to the guys who can read and understand all of those stories.
Well, it was easier back when I was doing it, of course, because there were fewer things to have to do, but it was also understood that that was the reality too. I mean, when I got at Marvel, it was like 10 years old, so there was 10 years of continuity as opposed to 50. But on the other hand, that continuity was real. I mean, those were supposed, you know, when I started writing the Avengers, those were supposed to be the Avengers, the same guys who had been there for 10 years. And you had to, you know, you had to stay within, I mean, you took your own approach and try to open up areas that interested you, but those, you know, you certainly didn't like reinvent the characters or try to get by without knowing what they had done previously. Again, that was part of being the writer, was to know that stuff. And it was true for all the writers. I mean, not just me, anybody. If that was your job at Marvel, then you were supposed to know that stuff.
Right, right. No, definitely.
And if you don't, the readers will definitely point it out to you.
Yep.
Well, that's their job, right?
Yes.
Oh, you made a mistake this week. Oh, okay. So
that earring was green, not blue. Oh my gosh. Uh-huh. End of the world.
So just, you know, I'm just curious too, how did you get involved with your working with video games and working with Atari?
Well, I left comics forever in 1977. Had enough of them at that point in time. And I just, you know, the last thing I did was the Batman run, where I sort of reinvented the guy in terms of adult sensibilities and, you know, thought, okay, that's a good piece of work and that's a good place to stop. And I went off and traveled and did stuff. And then when I came back, I was looking for something else to do. And, I started writing novels. I wrote one book called The Point Man for Dell, and I got a contract, sold a second book to Dell called video veins, which was going to be set in the then hot concept of the Silicon Valley in the early 80s. And I knew a guy named Ted Richards who had done underground comics. His thing was Dope and Dan, about an army guy who smoked dope. And I knew that he was working for Atari. So I called him up and I said, I got questions about how this business works. And he said, I don't know the answer to any of that stuff, but come and work for us. And I said, well, no, I'm writing a novel. And he said, yes, but we'll give you a computer. Now we're talking about the Atari 800 computer, which is, you know, had 64K of memory and all that good stuff. But yes. 1982, pretty cool. So, you know, I gave the money back to Dell and I went off and started working for Atari. And they had me doing, you know, game design because that's what they did and that's what I was suited for. So, I mean, I find that interesting because I mean, Atari was a name at that point in time. I mean, working for Atari, you know, meant something. At the same time, it was still so early on. And then Atari, you know, went under. And then everybody remembers, who's old enough, Centipede and Pac-Man and all that kind of stuff. And so in like 2004, somewhere in there, I got hired by the then current incarnation of Atari to work in a place called Atari Labs, which was supposed to be sort of a think tank for where would we go next. And I found that interesting to come back and work for, you know, Atari, which had been through three or four different owners and so forth by that time. But we'd order, you know, pizza for lunch and people would come to the door and they'd go, wow, it's Atari. You know, and I'm like, oh, I all of a sudden it came to me just how iconic it was to, you know, have worked there at that time and been involved in them with them that early on. But that's been the case with most of my career, you know, and I mean, I've done comics, I've done video games, I've done a little animation. I mean, I, you know, stuff happens just if you sort of poke around, the opportunity sort of showed up. I never really went out to, you know, to work for Atari because Atari was so cool or Marvel or any of the rest of these things, you know,
right
place, right time.
Yeah, no, it's funny because I actually experienced something somewhat similar to that. My first job at a big company was with the TV Guide. But I started I'm sorry.
In Radnor, Pennsylvania, right?
Yes, yes. Wow, I'm always shocked when people know that's where their headquarters was.
I have no idea where Radnor is, but I know Radnor.
It's about 20 minutes outside of Philadelphia. Okay. But yeah, so that was the whole thing. Like everyone's like, oh, well, cause everyone has heard of TV Guide. We go up and say, oh, what? That must be a great job, blah, blah, blah. But of course, this was in 2000 when I started working there. And of course, you know how you obviously know how the publishing industry is. And, you know, it just was like, it wasn't such a great place to work at because of the atmosphere and what was going on and, you know, losing subscriptions and revenue going down the hole. So,
well, they got overwhelmed by all the channels, right? I mean, once the original TV Guide had to cover three networks and then maybe one independent station and then maybe another independent station, they didn't. Well, once there were, you know,
actually, they put themselves
500 channels.
One of the things a lot of people don't realize is they actually put themselves out of business because they worked with Comcast and the other cable providers for doing the interactive guides that were built into the TV. So,
yeah.
You have an interactive guide. Why do you need to buy a book anymore?
Yeah. After which a lot of people would say, oh, yeah, I buy TV Guide for the articles. which I actually used to because, you know, they do something on Stargate. And it's like, oh, yes, you know, the upcoming shows in Stargate. That's where I got my information from.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's not always cracked up to be to work at the company everyone thinks is wonderful. So then, I guess after that, is that when you went back into comics?
Yeah, I was working at Atari, and then Marvel called up maybe even specifically Jim Starlin. They had started the Epic line, and Starlin's Dread Star was going to be a book. It was probably Starlin who called me, but you know, in any event, they got in touch and said, you know, we'd like you to do something for us. And I thought, well, I had Coyote at that time. I'd done it for Eclipse, and thought, well, I'd like to do more of that. That would be good. That would work for what they're looking for in the Epic, in that line.
Mm-hmm.
And I can do it, you know, sort of on the weekends, which turned out to be somewhat illusory because I kind of didn't want to do anything on the weekends. I wanted to kick back after working, you know, 5 days a week for Atari. Eventually in 84, Atari got sold and we all got fired.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually... I'd gone down to San Diego for the convention. I wasn't doing comics. Well, I was doing the Coyote, but I wasn't really, you know, I was kind of like off in the distance. But I went down to San Diego, and both Jim Shooter, who was the editor-in-chief of Marvel at the time, mm-hmm. and Dick Giordano, who was the editor-in-chief of DC at the time, both came up to me and said, hey, you know, would you like to do, you know, do some work for us, do some regular comics? And I said, no, I'm pretty full right now. Thanks anyway. And I went home that Sunday, and Sunday night, my boss at Atari called and said, we're all going to get fired on Wednesday. So on Monday morning, I called both of those comic guys back up, and I said, you know, actually. And so that's when I came back and did, you know, West Coast Avengers and stuff for Marvel and Green Lantern for DC. I sort of felt like doing both of them since they both asked me, and I liked Green Lantern quite a bit. I did, that was the only thing I did for DC, and I did that because I liked Green Lantern a lot. And the other stuff I did from Marvel, I was happy with that too, but I sort of did more stuff from Marvel. But anyway, so having quit comics forever, now I was back doing comics and went on till 89 when I left again. And then went off. I mean, so I've sort of come and go out of comics. I've come and gone out of comics, as I'm sure you know.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, on the topic of your return to comics, I read somewhere that during that period of time, you had a pseudonym that you used as well, you wrote under?
Well, at the end, I had used the pseudonym John Harkness on like two or three books over the years to that point. Whenever I felt that the name Steve Englehart had started to become, I was hoping it meant something. It seemed like it meant something. You know, people could read that name and go, oh, I think I'll get something out of this book. And whenever I felt that I'd had to write a book too fast, or, you know, for whatever reason, I didn't feel that it was as good as it ought to be. I didn't put my name on it, you know? And then at the end of the 80s, you know, the time I consider the end of the Marvel age, they dumped Shooter as the editor and installed a different guy whose name I don't have to bring up at this time. But I mean, there's no reason, if you don't know, you don't need to know. But he obviously got his orders from above, and he came and he said, you know, we're not happy about having to pay guys like you a lot of money, because Spider-Man will always sell. It doesn't make any difference who does it. So we don't need, you know, star people doing these books. And that was the beginning of the whole, let's put out 14 Spider-Man books and they'll all be number one and they'll all come in a bag. I mean, that was the beginning of that era. So he said, you know, we're gonna like cut back and drop guys like you. And I negotiated a 6-month window to kind of wrap up my storylines and, you know, make it as smooth as possible. But I took my name off it at that point. I mean, so I went from Steve Englehart to SFX Englehart, which is SFX is a standard abbreviation for sound effects. And then I went to John Harkness. I didn't even want Englehart involved with it. Those last 6 months of Fantastic Four and Silver Surfer and West Coast Avengers, I mean, those were things where, again, I did my best because that's sort of what I like to do. That seemed like, I mean, I don't like to just sort of slough off on stuff. And at the same time, because I was being forced to wrap things up and truncate storylines I was doing and all that, I wasn't happy with it, so I ended up, taking my name off of it, in effect, right at the end. So that's the story of the pseudonym, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's funny, because that was Stan Lee's, obviously, everyone should know at this point that Stan Lee is a pseudonym. And then when he got into comics, he said, I'm not going to use Stanley Lieberman as my name, I'm going to use Stan Lee, so that when I go to write real books...
All right.
I can leave the comic guy behind, and apparently that never happened.
Yeah. Well, my motivation was different, but yeah, yes. I mean, there are times, I mean, you just sort of walk out there and all of a sudden you're on stage, and when you're, you know, I mean, I'm Marvel, so to speak, now and again. You know, I got into comics just because I wanted to get into comics, and certainly never had any idea that, 40 years later, I'd be getting interviewed about it, or that Star-Lord would be on a giant movie screen or any of that kind of stuff. Because, again, we were in a ghetto. I mean, we were in a comics ghetto, and we were entertaining other people who liked comics, and that was as far as anybody thought. Nobody thought about anything beyond that. And, you know, and if Stan was thinking about the books he was going to write, you know, good for him, but that's why he was a visionary all along, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. It's what was going to be my next thought. You know, I mean, when you have a career, that spans as long as yours has, you create a lot of different characters, and some of the characters have impact right away. Some of them don't, you know, so when you, now these movies are, you know, becoming more popular. Obviously they're giant blockbusters, and you see, you know, characters like Kilowog in the Green Lantern movie, and then of course Star-Lord in the Guardians of the Galaxy. Did you ever imagine that those characters would have, you know, gotten to that point and been on the big screen? And, you know, I also want to ask, are you happy with the way those characters have been presented?
The answer is no. I never expected to see him on the big screen. I mean, in the, and I'll get back to your second point, but, but you know, there was, there were two Captain America movies. There was a Doctor Strange movie, back in the '70s. They were terrible. Mm-hmm. Doctor Strange movie actually was sort of as good as it could be under at the time. But again, people who weren't in comics, and that includes people who made movies, if they got a job directing or writing a comic book movie, their default position was, this is a piece of crap. I don't really have to work too hard at this. And the movies reflected that. I mean, there was no commitment to try to, you know, please the fans and do anything. It was just like, here's a job, you know, somebody sold something somewhere, blah, blah, blah. So... If you thought, well, there's not going to be a whole lot of movies coming out of this stuff, and second of all, if there are, I'm not going to be interested in them, let alone anybody else. So certainly the way that changed, that's bizarre. Am I pleased? I'm very pleased with Star-Lord. I'm very pleased with the Marvel movies in general. I mean, you know, the last Captain America movie, all that stuff about Cap versus the government. I mean, you know, that's mine. All that stuff has been handled extremely well. I'm not all that pleased with Kilowog because Kilowog was supposed to be a big brutish looking guy who actually was quite intelligent. And, you know, after I left, they turned him into a drill sergeant. And that seems to be what he is these days. So,
yeah.
I look at that and I go, well, sorry they did that. I mean, in comics, in and of themselves, it's a periodical medium, and you know that when you stop writing Green Lantern, somebody else is going to start writing it right then and there, and they're going to do whatever they're going to do, and that's their right to do it. But, you know, if you kill Mockingbird or you kill Cat Matui across town, or, you know, ditch the Vision and Witch's kids or that kind of stuff, when you've done something and then people undo it, you know, I mean, on the one hand, as a professional, you go, that can happen, you know, whatever. And on the other hand, you go, well, that's a piece of shit. You know, I'm sorry that happened. But again, once you leave, you have no control. I mean, if you're not writing the book, you're not going to be standing over the next guy's shoulder trying to kibitz. So you just have to kind of roll with that. But no,
like you said, sometimes it's not even up to the writer. It's up to the guys who went on the retreat and came back with a brilliant idea.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's just, but that's how comics, you know, in one form or another, it's always whoever's actually doing the work that's making those decisions. As I say, that's migrated upward from the writer to the editor now. But yeah, I mean, you know, so fortunately, Marvel's doing a lot of movies, and fortunately, I think they're doing them real well. So, in general, whatever they do, I figure it's probably going to be pleasing to me. DC has taken a different approach, and it remains to be seen whether DC's movies are going to be pleasing to me or anybody if they're not directed by Christopher Nolan. So,
sad but true. Yes. Whatever.
Well, Marvel has the overall. They, you know, somebody was smart enough and tough enough to try to transfer the whole Marvel universe thing to the movies. And and I look back now. I mean, now of course we're all good with it. But I mean, I thought, you know, when they did that first Iron Man movie, the idea that was going to tie into the next movie and that the next movie would actually appear and all that kind of stuff. That's taken a leap of faith. Fortunately for them, they did it well and it all worked out. DC, you know, I mean, now they're talking about doing stuff across their universe, but they don't seem to have much of a plan other than, you know, let's hire auteurs and let them do what they do. And so it remains to be seen whether that will be successful. But, you know, I mean, three or four years ago, whenever it was, DC Warners came out with a press release and said, you know, we're going to build our entire thing around Superman, Batman, and Green Lantern, you know? And I thought, well, good, you know, I mean, Green Lantern, I love Green Lantern, me personally, as a, you know, good, that's a good thing to build a franchise around. And then that movie was so bad that there's no more Green Lantern movies. So Kilowog on screen remains an unknown at this point. But anyway, sorry, go on.
No, that's perfectly fine. It's actually something that we talk a lot about on this podcast. Not really sure because the thing also with DC, it was just like, okay, the Superman movie did well. And it was a success. Then they said, all right, well, let's do Batman v Superman. Put them together in a movie. Oh, okay, that's so great. And then now they're like sneaking in a Justice League movie. And it's just like, okay, well, do you really want to try to like put everything out and then make it work after that? We'll see what happens. It's
Yeah, I think they're trying. I mean, that whole Justice League thing sounds to me like they're trying to play catch up against the Avengers.
Right.
But of course, the Avengers had already established all of their, you know, main members by that time. And it all flowed organically. I'm not sure. I mean, you know, anything can work. And I can't say, I have no opinion really one way or the other, whether it will work. But I do think that if you're suddenly going to throw a Wonder Woman and a Flash and a Green Lantern and a Martian Manhunter and a, you know, whatever, all on screen at the same time, you better hope that every one of those characters is played by Robert Downey Jr. or something like that.
Some equivalent.
Yeah, you know, so they'll all, everybody will go, oh, yeah, I really like them. But if they turn into just a bunch of sort of guys in the background that don't really stand out, I don't think that advances your brand all that well, you know?
Right.
Yeah. But could be determined.
Hey, I'm the token cyborg guy.
Oh, that's just wrong.
Hey, it could be worse, you know. the what is it, Fantastic Four, Black Human Torch. I mean, you know, the rewriting entire swaths of continuity just to make a change, just to get a demographic instead of, you know.
Instead of writing a good story? Wait, what?
Yeah.
Or relying on already well-written stories?
Yeah.
So, all right. So, before we go off on that tangent, I actually... So, getting ready for the interview, this is something I thought maybe we could play with or play around with a little bit at the end here. I did a search. Obviously, everyone, you know, it's the day of the internet. You do a search on the person's name to find out some information. And an article came up from 2010 on Comic Book Resource, and it's the greatest Steve Englehart stories ever told. So how about I thought maybe we could go through the list real quick, and you could, you know, maybe say something about the story, and maybe you can tell us if you agree the story belongs on the list or not. What do you think?
Sure.
All right.
Wouldn't he think all of his stories belong on the greatest stories ever told?
No, his greatest stories. You know, he had to pick a few favorite, I think. So number 15 they have on here is from Marvel premiere featuring Doctor Strange. Doctor Strange versus Shuma Gareth.
Yeah, I'm real happy with that. Well, if we're going to go through 15 of them, I won't belabor any one of them. But yeah, that was the first one that Frank Brunner and I did.
Yes.
That sort of established our Doctor Strange right there.
Number 14, this actually, I'm a big Captain America fan, so I remember this one. The Return of the 1950s Captain America. It was Captain America and Falcon number 156. Years before, here's the write-up. Years before the comic, writers routinely explained away past continuity blips. Englehart wrote a cool adventure where he learns that the 1950s Captain America, the Commie Smasher, was the actual whole other Captain America. That was, you know, and then I think from that story kind of birthed the ideas of there being two Captain Americas, which actually that's another something strange later down was birth of that. You're being quiet, so I don't know if you remember writing this story.
Yeah, no, I'm just listening. Well, when I said I wouldn't talk much, so I'll try to be quick, but when they gave me Captain America was in danger of cancellation. Nobody was buying Captain America. And the reason was pretty simple. He had a flag on his chest and it was Vietnam time. And so your basic comic book audience was not real thrilled about a guy who stood up for America when there was a lot of unrest in America, particularly amongst draft age people. And, you know, when I was given a book, they said this thing may get canceled if something doesn't happen here. And I thought, you know, long and hard about it and decided that I could make a difference. I could establish a difference between a guy who stood for the ideals that they taught us in school and what the actual country was doing at the actual time. And the easiest way to do that was to, you know, do the 50s Captain America to show our guy versus another approach to the whole thing.
Right, right.
And that, you know, that ended up saving the book. I mean, in those days, you could turn books around real quickly because retailers, and they didn't even really have many comic book stores in those days. It was mostly newsstands, but people could order, you know, 25 copies of something. And if they sold all 25, they could order another 25 and they'd be there the next day. I mean, that was, very unlike the way stores run now. So if a comic had an interesting story and you read it, you could go to your buddy and say, you know, hey, you should buy a copy of this. And he could, and then he would tell his friend. And so, 6 months after they gave me that book, Captain America was the number one title. And primarily because of that storyline, whatever. And that pretty much established, you know, that pretty much established that I would be getting more work for having, you know, figured that out. But I was just trying to, you know, trying to do right by Captain America and try to figure out, you know, how do we make this guy accessible. Anyway, so number 13.
Number 13 is in Doctor Strange number 13. Eternity helps recreate the world.
Yeah, that was I was doing a story which was leading toward, I mean, they kept saying if stuff doesn't happen right, the world will come to an end. And I, you know, and of course, the traditional concept is the world doesn't come to an end.
Right.
And then I thought, but this is Doctor Strange. Why not? You know, why can't the world come to an end and then be recreated? And that was kind of funny because I made sure that the only person who knew that was Doctor Strange, that the world had died and been recreated. And it's spelled out in the story that when it's recreated, it's recreated exactly the way it was. So that nobody has any memory of, you know, anything untoward happening. It all just seems normal. And I thought it was kind of cool then that there would be this huge secret like that, and only Doctor Strange would know because he was Doctor Strange and he's the kind of guy who would know. But I did get flack from some of the other, I mean, I remember, I think it was Len Wein who was writing the book at the time, but I mean, somebody said, so you're telling me that my Peter Parker died and came back and this is a different, you know, this is a recreated Peter Parker. And I'm like, yeah, but it doesn't make any difference because you can't tell the difference and it's all this, but I could see what, you know, and thought that part exactly through, and I could see why that might be a problem for people. So, but anyway, that was, you know,
Number 12, probably one of my favorite early, not too early, but one of my favorite Captain America stories. Because without this story, as you said, we don't have the attitude he has in The Winter Soldier. We don't have Civil War, which is Steve Rogers quits as Captain America becomes Nomad.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, just the idea that Captain America could turn his back on the government because, you know, because the world he stands for is changing, or it isn't what he believes in.
Yeah. Well, I had, you know, I'd gone to the trouble of establishing that he believed in something, you know, that he believed in the stuff they taught you. And it, you know, and thus he wasn't responsible, didn't have to carry the baggage of an unpopular war, et cetera, et cetera. But then when, you know, Nixon did his crimes, and got impeached, and that was a huge thing in America. The entire summer of 1974 was given over to live televised hearings of the impeachment stuff, and it all unfolded very much like a novel. I mean, it was kind of like, it was extremely dramatic, and they'd get to a thing, and then it would get to a point where if Nixon could just hold it together well enough, he might be able to get by. And then it would fall apart. This is all ancient history now, but I mean, there was a gap in the tapes that he had. It had been erased, and there was always something, and it was just fascinating. And I'm sitting there like the rest of America watching this unfold, and I'm sitting there like the guy writing Captain America going, how the hell is he supposed to not react to this?
Right.
You know,
right.
This is like a big deal in America, and it's totally against what they taught us in school. And so I conceived of this idea that he would say that, you know, things have just gone off the tracks so much that I can't do this anymore. And that was great for me because, I mean, I mean, that was a story, but then what happens next, you know, and I was just finding out month by month as we went. I said, you know, somewhere very early on, you know, Captain America will come back.
Right, you know? Right.
But he was gone for 8 months. I mean, I just, you know, I was just sort of exploring what all could happen if he went down that other path. And there's a case again. I mean, I created Nomad, but Nomad was just Steve Rogers under another identity.
Right.
Never did I assume that there would be another Nomad and that it would, you know, and then he'd become. But of course, any character in comics is able to be picked up off the scrap heap and used somehow or another.
Yes. Yes.
Star-Lord being a case in point. So
yes, we're all waiting for Squirrel Girl's time in the sun. That's
All right. So number 11, the initial Silver Surfer storyline with the Elders trying to kill Galactus, which was Silver Surfer number 9.
Yeah. When I got the Silver Surfer, he'd been stuck on Earth for over 10 years. And every time they tried to do the Silver Surfer, it didn't really sell. I mean, they had Mobius on it. John Byrne did one. I mean, there were all these people who theoretically could sell a comic, but they couldn't sell the Silver Surfer. And yet he was this iconic figure, kind of like it was kind of the Captain America story again. Mm-hmm. I mean, they couldn't. Everybody knew who he was, and he had, you know, Dayglo posters on the walls and stuff, but and rock albums dedicated to him and all that stuff. But they couldn't sell the comic because, to me, it was clear that he was trapped on Earth when he was, you know, when he was introduced to us as a guy who was free throughout all of space, and then he got trapped on Earth. And isn't that sad? Well, it is. But 10 years later. It was time to do something else. And so they gave me this book and I said, I want to get him off Earth. And they said, no, he's trapped on Earth. That's what it's all about. And I'm like, well, okay, I'll take my best shot at it. And then for whatever reason, they changed their minds and came back to me and said, okay, you can get him off of Earth. So then I got to do the series I wanted, but I also got to get him out into space and he could interact with any of Marvel's space characters who, you know, to this point they'd met the Fantastic Four or they'd met the Avengers or they'd met whatever. But now they were all available to this guy who could go anywhere and connect them. And so, yeah, I needed to resolve stuff with Galactus for the Surfer, and the Elders were in there, and the Inbetweener showed up later. I mean, it was all that stuff was just available to play with, so I played.
Cool.
Just speaking of the Elder, God, you created a character called Gaia, right?
Did
you?
Yeah. I mean, Gaia, I mean, it's just based on the goddess who pre-existed
us. So. Most people don't think of pagan goddesses. I'm just wondering why you picked that one instead of going with one of the other pantheons.
I think it was in the 70s that Earth Day got started. It was somewhere in there. There was just a sort of more of a people were thinking about the Earth, and Gaia is the goddess of Earth. I mean, you could go with... drawn a blank. I mean, but the goddess of Earth in the German pantheon, Erda, maybe. Obviously, I don't even know about her, but I mean, some people might have known about her. But there aren't an infinite number of goddesses of the Earth out there. So, I mean, Gaia, you know, and I mean, she is Greek. It's not, she wasn't invented by witches or anything. So, not that there's anything wrong with that. So,
So in the interest of time, I'm going to jump around a little bit or jump ahead a little bit. This one's, I think, an important one to bring up, which is the Avengers number 118, Avengers Defenders War. And I don't bring it up because I'm sure you've heard that they're going to do the Defenders in a Netflix series. So this is something we could eventually see on the big screen.
Yeah. Well, I love the Defenders.
I love them too.
That was an early, but I mean, I loved it when I was just a reader. Mm-hmm. And then that was one of the first books I got. I got Captain America and the Defenders, both drawn by Sal Buscema, at the same time. And I was really happy to work with Doctor Strange and the Hulk and the Submariner and all that. And then they gave me the Avengers, which I was also happy to get. But it got to be Marvel had always done annuals, or not always, but for the last number of years, they had done, you know, a special 25-cent book in the summertime that was usually like an extra long story about the character and then a reprint from mm-hmm. the early stuff, which was still very cool because you didn't, you know, if you hadn't been there, you hadn't seen that stuff. And then for whatever reason that summer, they decided they weren't going to do that. They weren't going to do any annuals. And I thought, well, I had such a great time in those previous summers with the special thing for the summer. I thought, well, maybe I could do something special within the context of, the regular books. And I was writing both of those. So I thought, well, what about Avengers versus Defenders? And Marvel was a very, you know, you had to turn your books in on time and they had to sell. But other than that, Marvel did not edit. They just handed you the books and said, here, if you can make those two things happen, you can do it. But so I went to Roy because this was kind of an unusual thing. I went to Roy Thomas, the editor in chief, and I said, here's what I want to do. And he said, if you screw any one of those books up, it'll throw everything off schedule. And I said, I won't do that. And he said, okay. And that was the, you know, that was the complete editorial oversight of the thing. So I set out to, you know, to do that all summer long.
So don't screw it up is basically the instructions.
Yeah. I mean, really, that's pretty much it. If you screw it up too badly, then you get fired and
right.
somebody else will be writing it next month, you know. But, I mean, they didn't have time. Marvel was doing so many books, and they were still a small company, really. So they didn't have time to be, like, doing a lot of rewrites and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
It was, again, it was up to the writer. That's why the writer had to know that stuff.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there was no time right. to be running it through editorial.
Right,
you know?
Right, exactly. Number four, Avengers 147, The Serpent Crown.
Yeah. It's right near the end of my run.
Yeah.
I thought the Serpent Crown, the ability to take over minds. I mean, that was kind of a cool thing. And that also involved going into the other dimension where the Squadron Supreme or whatever their adjective was at the time, lived. And, so I just threw a bunch of things together and came up with as complex a story as I could get away with.
All right. Number three, The Secret Empire, Captain America and Falcon, 175. It's funny, the write-up basically just says, this is a story that made Steve Rogers quit as Captain America. It achieves things that you likely would never be able to get away with today.
I'm not sure what that, well, I mean, again, things have changed, and right. I'm not working in that editorial context today, but I'm not, off the top of my head, I'm not sure what that would be, what was done there that you couldn't.
Yeah,
I do know that, I mean, in the late 80s, when, again, Marvel decided that they didn't need writers, one of the things that was said was, you know, I had taken Reed and Sue out of the Fantastic Four, and one of the things that was said to me was, you know, how are we supposed to license lunchboxes if the characters aren't in the books, you know? It could, you know, it was all money driven then. This was much earlier in time, but it could have been that same kind of deal that, you know, writing Captain America out for 8 months would be impossible today because you need the licensing deals. Maybe.
True. Number two is from Bat Detective Comics, number 472, Strange Apparitions. The amount of awesomeness collected into Englehart's Detective Comics run is simply staggering. Silver St. Cloud, The Return of Hugo Strange, The Laughing Fish, plus the revitalization of one of DC's best baddies, Deadshot.
Oh.
Marshall Rogers, yeah. Of course, did the artwork.
Yes, he did. Yeah, well, that was going to be my swan song in comics. So I went over to DC. They asked me to come over and revamp the entire Justice League, make them like your Avengers, you know? And I said, okay, I'll do that, but I want to do Batman all by himself because I love Batman. And I thought, this is my chance to do Batman, and I'm going to do something as memorable as possible, and then I'm going to walk out the door. I wanted to go back to the original feel of the book in the 30s. There'd been enough reprints. There were no archive editions and stuff in those days, but there'd been reprints from like the first year of Batman. And I really liked how dark it was and how, you know, and the villains were people like Hugo Strange, right. You know, kind of pulp villains. And the Joker was a homicidal maniac, killed people, you know, with abandon. All that stuff had been lost. And I really wanted to go back and get that again and then reconceptualize it for the time that I was in. And along the way, I thought one of my pet peeves about comics characters, particularly DC characters, was if Lois Lane or Lana Lang or any of these people sort of batted their eyes at the character would go, oh, gosh, no, I'm not really interested in women. And I thought, that's ridiculous. This guy's supposed to be a grown man, you know?
Right.
And so I definitely set out, in addition to all that other stuff, I wanted to see Bruce Wayne fully realized. And the way to do that was to give him a girlfriend. And the way to do that was to have him sleep together. And this was under the comics code. So it was as overt as it could be and no more. By turning him into an adult guy with a girlfriend that he actually slept with, et cetera, that's the basis, you know, for the movie franchise later. I mean, that's, they tried to make a movie out of those stories and eventually kind of did the Michael Keaton, Jack Nicholson thing. And then that led to more Batman, and that led to X-Men, and that led to, you know, everything. I mean, I, in all modesty, I'll take full credit for having created the entire film genre. But yeah, I just had all these things that I wanted to do, and I only had a certain amount of time to do them because I, you know, I had determined I was only going to be there for a year. I told them going in, I'm only going to be here for a year, and then I'm going to blow off comics. And Detective Comics was only published 8 times a year. It was only published 7 times a year, I think, and I think they came up with an 8th one in the middle of it. In fact, yeah, they did. But anyway, so, I mean, I knew I had to get it all in 7 issues, as it turned out, 8. So there was no wasted motion in any of that. That was, you know, I knew what I wanted to do, and I knew I had to do it in a very efficient manner, which actually I really liked. Sorry to keep this up. But I thought it worked really well for the Batman. I mean, you know, the pacing of it was very important, that there was this kind of driving thing behind it. That was all done script in advance. Most of, you know, most of the work I've done over the years is Marvel style, which is where you come up with a plot and give it to the artist, and the artist draws that story to the best of his ability, and then you get it back and you write the dialogue to fit the pictures. And if everybody's doing his job right, that goes smoothly. And I actually prefer that approach in general, because then I'm looking at the same pictures you're looking at, so the dialogue can be tailored exactly to what the overall impact is going to be. The alternative is to write script in advance, where you say panel one, Batman says to Silver, blah, 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 panel two, you know, whatever. I didn't like that approach very much, but I was leaving the country, and they, and DC was taken, you know, they hadn't really figured out who was going to draw this book. So I wrote those things script in advance, and the positive side there was, you know, I just had to take, I had to completely visualize it. And I could pace it exactly the way I wanted to, et cetera, et cetera. The odds were, since there was like all the cool people, all the stars at DC had gone over to Marvel. Neil Adams had gone to Marvel. Gil Kane had gone to Marvel. Even people like Bob Brown, who were, you know, good, solid second rank guys at DC, they'd gone to Marvel. So the odds were that this book, you know, all, you know, these scripts were all going to be drawn by a couple of hacks. And that was another reason to try to make the scripts as good as possible, because I figured they'd probably get degraded somewhat. Little did I know that they somehow came up with Marshall Rogers and Terry Austin. And little did I know until I didn't know this until just like 6-7 years ago, not long before Marshall died, actually, that DC hated their artwork. And every month they would call them in and just ream them up one side and down the other about how terrible this was. And it didn't look anything like what DC artwork ought to look like, and blah, 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 blah. I mean, it was just, it's amazing that DC, it's amazing that DC has even lasted this long. but everything was just kind of like, you know, I wrote the scripts and then who knew what could happen. And it turned out that I not only good art, but I got a couple of guys who are willing to stand up through all that to turn out the good art, you know?
Right, right.
So,
and then last but not least, and this is also fitting with a movie that's coming up this summer, The Celestial Madonna, which is a giant size Avengers, number 4, the conclusion to your long origin of Mantis. I'm not going to go into the whole thing, but this issue also included the wedding between Scarlet Witch and Vision, which I know a lot of people who are fans of the movies and whatnot don't realize that those two characters were married at one point in the comics.
Yeah. Let me ask you, before I say this, do you know for sure that Mantis is going to be in this movie?
Oh, not Mantis, but the Vision and Scarlet Witch are. Oh,
okay, because I've heard rumors, but I haven't heard them lately. I thought, well, maybe. Maybe you guys know something I don't.
No, so,
somebody would have ferreted that out by now.
The last rumor I heard about Mantis is people were saying, thought that's who, not Sky, but the other, or well, possibly Sky was going to be Mantis, or the other character from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Flowers. I can't think of her actual character's name off the top of my head. So
Marina.
What?
Reyna.
Reyna, yes. So that was some of the internet rumors that were going around. I didn't hear that. I mean, she would fit, but.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's an infinite number of internet rumors, but yeah. About 6 months ago, apparently in some trailer, there was an Asian woman in the background, and people said, oh, that's going to be Mantis.
Yes,
and
I'm yes. Like, yeah, no, that's right. You know, I did. Yes.
But, you know, Marvel certainly, you know, when I went, I was invited down to L.A. for the Hollywood premiere of Guardians of the Galaxy last summer. Okay. And when they showed us that movie, it did not have the Howard the Duck thing at the end. And, you know, I sat through all the credits and then there was nothing there. And I said, what's up? And they said, well, we don't want it to get out what the surprise is going to be. So it wasn't until the movie was actually released that it had the Howard the Duck thing on the end. So Marvel doesn't tell me, you know, right. if any of my characters are going to show up. So I don't really know. But in any event, you know, Roy Thomas had put the Scarlet Witch and the Vision together. When I inherited that book, I really liked the relationship between the two. When I came up with Mantis and was able to inject her into the whole thing and cause, you know, jealousy and intrigue and all that good stuff.
Right, right.
That was all there. And so when it came time to sort of wrap up that entire thing, it was sort of my nature to try to wrap up as many things as possible, to make it as big as possible. And I knew Mantis was going to marry the Katati, the tree. And I thought, well, but the Scarlet Witch and Vision are really close to getting married. Why not do that too? So that all went in there. I don't know if there's something else about that you want to know or no.
Do you think, I mean, they're just introducing, at least we know Scarlet Witch and Vision in this movie. Do you think that's a relationship they'll explore on the big screen?
Well, I hope so. I mean, because I really like those characters. That's a lot of what I've done. You know, I wanted to do comics, obviously, because I liked comics, which meant I liked the characters in the comics. So a lot of the characters, when I write them, I really like them.
Right.
Comics, when you're writing comics, you're sitting alone in a room. And if you're not entertaining yourself, you're probably not going to entertain anybody else. So I sort of went out, you know, I thought it's a good idea to entertain myself here while I'm doing this stuff. So I'd get into these characters. And again, you know, I'm still pissed off that they killed Cat Matui over in Green Lantern, you know, because, yeah. I mean, I went through that whole thing about you got to accept it, blah, blah, blah. And yet I really liked Cat Matui. I really liked Mockingbird. I really liked the Vision and the Witch together. Thought they made a really good couple. The superheroic dynamics were good, thought that the interpersonal relationships were good. It's just, you know, I was going to say it's a classic love story. I don't know if you can sort of say that within the context of the entire history of comics, but.
Right.
It's a pretty good love story. So if they're smart, that'll play out over the next, you know, 3 or 4 years in whatever movies those two are in.
Yeah, I'm hoping they explore it as well. You know, it's we had the movie Her with last year with a guy falling in love with his phone. So, yeah. You know, this is just the next logical evolution, I think.
Well, I mean, Roy had set the Vision up as an android, but a very human sort of android.
Yes.
And I continued that. I never thought that he was actually human, and he did have limitations. But he was as human as he could be when they, you know, when they turned him into a toaster, you know, that's like,
right.
I didn't like that. I was not about that. Cause I don't, but you know, whatever.
Okay. Cool. So, before we wrap it up, is there anything you want to plug, anything you want to talk about, that you're working on currently? Mm-hmm.
Not really. I finished a three-part thing, a series of novels from Tor Books about Max August, and I'm working on another project now, but it's not ready to be announced yet.
Okay.
So, no, I'm just sort of hanging out.
All right. And people can find you at steveengelhart.com. Are you on the Twitters?
Nope.
Okay.
No.
So if you guys want to know anything that's going on with Steve, just go to his website. Cool. All right. I think this is a good place to put a pin in it for this week. Thank you again very much for doing this.
You're welcome. And, thank you guys.
Yeah. And as we say every week, on this show, boys and girls, don't let your cape go out in the door. Have a good week.
Speaking of capes, you can tug on ours by joining the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, or Google Plus at Superhero Speak. If you have any comments on my bad jokes, you can email me at dave@superheroespeak.com.
You can also subscribe to our podcast through iTunes, Stitcher, and various other channels. Or if you'd like to tease the beard of knowledge, you can email me at ben@superheroespeak.com.
We also occasionally rant about things on our website, superheroespeak.com. Or, if you'd like to further discuss the prowess of Rainbow Dash versus anybody in the greater geek universe, you can email me at john@superheroespeak.com.
And don't forget to check out our Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. companion show, Agents of Speak, which you can watch live most Tuesdays around 9 p.m. on our Google Plus page, or archived on our YouTube channel. Now let go of our cape.
Superhero Speak promo, take one. Get your promo done.
So do you read comic books? Do you enjoy comic book movies? Well, then you should be listening to Superhero Speak.
What's that, Dave?
It is a weekly podcast where we talk about comic book movies, TV shows, cartoons, and all other things comic book related.
That sounds great. Who hosts it?
Well, I host it.
Oh, I'm out.
We also have Ben. You're one of the hosts.
Oh, you lost me.
Okay. We also have John.
I'll do anything for money.
Well, okay. If John's there, I might show up every once in a while.
And occasionally we have Christopher Walken.
Yeah. Once in a while, when things are rough on the budget, I might step in and help out.
It's a good thing we have that padding in the budget to have him show up every once in a while.
He shows up for Oreos and orange juice. So I don't know.
Have you seen his IMDb page? He needs the work. Really.
The Headless Horseman was a hell of a role. Hell of a role.
If you want a podcast that feels like the conversations that you have in your local comic book shop, then you should check us out on superheroespeak.com, iTunes, and Stitcher.
Podcasters, I'm going to have you redo that entire promo. It wasn't working for me at all.
It was the plaid and the stripes, wasn't it?
Listen, you had an hour at Mood. I don't know what you did with your time.
Mostly slingshotting bow ties.
So, Mr. Gunn, what is your favorite comic book?
Personally, I like The Adventures of Superman because I love that costume. It's so skin tight and it's adequately designed.
Have you ever heard of the Ambiguously Gay Duo?
I have not.
I think you would enjoy them.
Oh, it sounds naughty. David, you rascal.
Oh my gosh.